have Manny Wei from MIT. She will tell us about quantum scores in QFT.
Cool, yeah, thanks so much. And yeah, thank you for showing up. So yeah, so the title of my talk is Quantum Scores in Quantum Field Theory, and this is work with Jordan Kotler in this paper listed over here. And yeah, so I will tell you what quantum scars are in quantum mechanics before trying to like generalize this to the field theory case. So just for a quick run through, kind of what we're interested in, is we want to think about how do we describe chaotic quantum systems. And I'm going to give you like a definition of quantum scars like later on, but for now we can think of it as like a non-perturbative phenomenon that occurs in chaotic systems where we might otherwise expect thermalization to occur. So there are like a bunch of phenomena that break thermalization, such as like if you're in an integrable system or many body localization, and this is like distinct from those two other phenomena. So what we're gonna do is we're gonna generalize the formulation of quantum scars from quantum mechanics to quantum field theory. And then I will just talk briefly, very briefly, about potential applications. So one application would be to these Rydberg AMO systems, and there are also potential applications to quantum gravity. Great, so on this slide, I'm just gonna tell you what a quantum scar is first, like kind of pictorially, and then the next slide, I'm just gonna talk about it in terms of equations. So basically, classically, we would expect chaotic systems to be ergodic. We expect them to thermalize. But in the case of quantum scars, what we actually find is that the eigenstates of a chaotic quantum system will have enhanced probability distribution around unstable periodic orbits. So what that means is, if we look at this picture, so this picture is, and this was discovered by Eric Heller in 1984. So a lot of this is gonna be like results on semi-classical quantum chaos from like the 80s. But this is a picture directly from Heller's paper. And kind of the setup he had in this paper was, so this is the problem of chaotic billiards. And basically you have, so this billiard, which is shaped like a rectangle capped off by semicircles on the sides. And then what I can do is like, you can just shoot off a particle into the billiard or like a billiard ball or something. And kind of in the most generic case, you would expect your billiard ball to take a very chaotic path. So you would be like, okay, maybe like every point on my billiard space is going to be like visited with equal probability. But there are certain special, like if you shoot the billiard ball starting from like a special initial angle, you might end up with like an orbit where instead the billiard ball just like bounces off the sides in a closed orbit. And then in that case, it will not visit every single site with equal probability. So this is what we mean by a periodic orbit. And this is like the quantum mechanical version of this problem. So basically what you do is it kind of looks like a particle in like a well, except your well is, so this is, this whole space is going to be like my well. And maybe I'm gonna say V is equal to zero inside and V is equal to infinity outside. And then you have your usual Hamiltonian with like P squared over 2m plus like your potential. And this is the potential. So that's what the quantum version of this problem might look like. And the plot over here is basically, so this is a plot of probability, of the probability function, and a darker spot just means it's more probable. A lighter spot means that it's less probable. So over here, this orbit has been kind of plotted, this periodic orbit, and we can kind of see that along the orbit, the probability density is increased. And that is basically what scarring is. So you can kind of see this visually. And you see it as oscillatory fringes. So this is kind of the definition. Yep.
No, you can finish your sentence.
Oh, I was just going to say this is like the heuristic definition I would give using a picture. But yeah.
There it seems like if I just tweak the system slightly, that orbit is going to go away.
Yeah, exactly.
So is this, mm-hmm. maybe that's the whole point of your talk, but is this a feature we expect to see like generically in some sense, or is it a very special feature of, you know, tuning the system in a particular way?
Yeah, so that's a good observation. And this is a sense in which I would say these periodic orbits are unstable. Yeah, so it's a very like small fraction of your total space where you might actually expect to see these special orbits. And also, so generically, both stable and unstable orbits cause scarring, but we terminologically call quantum scars to be the unstable periodic orbits. And in general, in like a chaotic system, you would expect most orbits to be unstable anyways. So they can be unstable. And this it could be the case that if you just like perturb it a little, then it goes away.
So there's two kinds of perturbation. One is mm-hmm. I could change the boundary, or you know, I could move the points or move the orbit a little bit away from where it is, and mm-hmm. then it'll go all crazy.
Sure.
But the other perturbation is perturb the system or perturb the potential, which is more what I was interested in. And it was more a question, you know, am I going to find scarring only when, you know, the parameters of my potential or my system are tuned in a special way, or is it sort of a generic feature of a large class of systems?
Yeah, I would say that generally when you have like a chaotic quantum system with unstable periodic orbits, like you should be able to see scarring. And I think that'll become clearer when we kind of see what situations we can derive the scar formula in. Is that whenever you have a periodic orbit and just in the neighborhood of that periodic orbit, you should expect scarring, yeah. Yes?
I think we need that much fine-tuning, right? I mean, this is the phenomenon, this kind of phenomenon people see experiment of a large scale thing. So yeah, we need unstable periodic orbits, but I don't think we need that much. That means I can't say precisely. Something we can see in actual very large systems.
So now maybe the answer to this is simply that what I'm about to describe is a periodic or a stable periodic orbit. But if we launch a ball from the, let's say, midpoint of the top edge mm-hmm. and aim directly for the midpoint of the semicircle, and you know we'll form a diamond-like orbit.
Yeah.
Is that one stable? And because if so, that makes sense. But if it's unstable, why don't we see it in the scarring here?
So that's a periodic orbit, and both stable and unstable periodic orbits do cause a scar phenomenon. So you would see it in either case.
But we don't.
But I think in the literature, like when we use the term quantum scars, we usually refer to it as an unstable periodic orbit. But like both would cause scarring, and like you would see the enhanced probability distribution around both like a stable and unstable orbit.
So is that diamond-like orbit a stable one?
I mean, I would guess that it's probably also unstable in the way that this is, that like if you just change the initial conditions a little, but off the top of my head, like I don't know. But yeah, I'm sure you could like write it down and just check for stability.
So then, sorry, doesn't that mean that since it is, if we assume it's unstable, shouldn't it appear as a dark line in this diagram?
So there should also be a scar for that, yeah.
Okay.
I think also confused about what this picture is showing that. So this is like somehow some, this picture is somehow only representing the scarring around that orbit. Right?
That's correct. I guess in general, like, I think in this paper, they have like a picture for each orbit and like specifically like what the scar pattern for each orbit looks like. But yeah, I would expect scarring from all of my orbits, I guess. But yeah, I guess like, so I guess you're saying that maybe we should have like all these pictures being overlaid.
I guess I'm confused what this picture shows.
So this is a picture showing just the contribution from one particular orbit.
I see.
Yeah. Are there more questions or?
But just to follow
yeah,
up on
sure.
that, in the experiment, mm-hmm. maybe you're going to tell us about or Eddie was hinting at, I'm going to see sort of scars with different periods. Like when I excite the system, I'll see many different scars with.
Yeah, sure. Periods. Sure.
Yeah, okay.
So I guess in equations, so when we talk about a system thermalizing, we mean that it obeys the microcanonical ensemble, and the scars are going to be like a correction on top of this expectation we would get from the microcanonical ensemble. So what we're going to do is we're going to say we have our Hamiltonian, and then we have our eigenstates, which I'm just going to index by n. And then our probability distribution is going to be the square of the wave function. But another thing we're going to do is we're going to smear over energy. And what that means is I'm going to take a small window. So if I have fixed energy E, I'm going to take a small window of size epsilon around it. And I'm going to consider all the eigenstates that appear in that epsilon-sized band. And this is something I'm also going to talk about later on. But the reason why we want to do this is because generically in chaotic quantum systems, like we can't resolve individual eigenstates. And so we talk about an energy band. So kind of with this in mind, the expectation we would get from the microcanonical ensemble is that our probability distribution might look like a delta function that is just centered on the energy band. So everything in this energy window is equally probable. But with quantum scars, we will have instead, so this microcanonical ensemble term plus this delta P scar correction. And now I'll talk a bit about just like these motivating applications. So specifically, these are applications where you might want to think about many body scars or the field theory case. And because this work is not actually about that, like I'm just going to talk about it briefly. But kind of the first motivation is in these AMO systems of Rydberg arrays, there is an experimental observation of periodic revivals following a quantum quench. So normally after a quench, you would expect thermalization. And so this was unexpected. And I guess this figure is of their periodic revivals. But basically the way the system works is it effectively, so it's basically, you can effectively think of it as spins on a lattice with certain kinetic constraints. And the, what the constraint is so at each site, you can have a spin that is in the ground state or the excited state. But with the constraint, no two spins can both be in the excited state at the same time. So that is the kinetic constraint. And what they did was they started in a very special state, which they call the Z2 order state, which is basically every other state is either, so every other state is like ground state, excited, ground, excited. So that's the sense in which they call it Z2. And then I think what they call a domain wall here on the y-axis of this plot is just like an expanse of sites where they are all in the same state. So like, let's say they're all in the ground state. And then the way they quench this is they have a certain detuning parameter, which they use to adjust how much order is in the state. So you can have a state that's like completely, all the spins are in the ground state versus like the Z2 state that I mentioned. And I think by tuning this parameter delta, that's how they go between these two states. So the quench is that they rapidly tune delta. And then, so they look at the density of the domain walls and they find the oscillatory behavior, which is kind of unexpected because the system where you might expect thermalization. And this is a many body system. It's like many spins on a lattice. And then the plot on the right is just, I think this was someone doing numerics of the system afterwards, but they were trying to show that, yeah, these are special non-thermalizing states. One way to see this is in the entanglement entropy. So normally in thermalization, you would expect the entropy to scale as a volume law. But here for these like special states, the entropy is a lot lower. And then I think they also, in this like same numerics paper, they kind of also looked at one-point functions and confirmed that for these special states, they didn't obey the ETH. And I think like the generic states like scale with the size of the Hilbert space. So that's exponential in the number of sites. But I think for these special states, like they found that they scaled like with the number of sites or something like that. And so these were like kind of dubbed quantum scars, but I think it was not clear in these papers like how you actually would rigorously define what are actually your periodic orbits and what does it mean to have a trajectory. So I guess the idea would be like maybe there's an application here where we can kind of help clarify, are these actually quantum scars in the sense that Heller meant quantum scars? And then, so for the second application of quantum gravity, so this is specifically an ADS CFT where we know that if you have a gravitational theory in anti-de Sitter space, it is dual to a conformal field theory in one dimension lower. And so in that case, you might expect that unstable orbits like around black holes in ADS should correspond to scarred states in the dual CFT. So there have also been some like explorations about this idea in these two papers that, and multiple papers that I've cited here, but also having like a better understanding of in what sense these are many body scars and just being able to characterize them better. So yeah, so these are potential applications, but like not actually the focus of this talk. Yeah, sure.
Unstable orbits in around black hole is just like something circling around?
I think so, yeah. I think they mean orbit in that sense, yeah. Great, so kind of the objectives for this work is what we're gonna do is we're gonna kind of re-derive and clarify the results from all these like semi-classical chaos papers from the 1980s. So the few body case of quantum scars in a way that, so that they can be generalized to field theory. And we're going to base most of our analysis on this paper from 1987 by Bogomolny. So he basically derives quantum scars in position space. And we'll find that that generalizes better to the field theory case. But there are other formulations of quantum scars. There's a paper by Barry who does this with Wigner functions. But we're just gonna focus on this paper. So right, so we're gonna generalize the results to field theory. And then after that, we'll just give examples of field theories that do contain scar states to say that kind of you can find these. So quantum scars in quantum mechanics. So I'll try to talk through a bit of the derivation, but I'm also not gonna go into it like super in detail. But basically what we wanna compute is this quantity over here, which is basically, so we have psi squared, which is a probability distribution, and then we're smearing it, and we're gonna smear it over both energy and position. And I will also tell you why that's important. But energy smearing, I kind of talked about earlier a bit, but this is just that we're going to consider an energy window. So we have fixed energy E, and we're gonna have a window of size epsilon around it. And we want epsilon to be larger than the level spacing of the system and smaller than E. And the reason why we want this is, as I mentioned, that generally in chaotic systems, it's hard to resolve individual eigenstates. So we want to talk about energy window. So for the position smearing, what this means is that we're gonna basically have this convolution with a Gaussian. What that will get us is that that's what's going to get us the periodic orbits. And I'll also talk about this a bit later. So we're smearing both in energy and position. The energy smearing is going to be controlled by this epsilon parameter, which I kind of told you we want it to be bigger than the level spacing and smaller than E. The position smearing is going to be controlled by this parameter called delta, which I'm going to comment on a bit more later as well. But that's what's going to set the scale for the position smearing.
What is F and Z?
So F is just generically any function. So if there's like any function and I want to smear it with respect to delta.
Sure.
Yeah, and then delta is going to set the size of like the Gaussian that I'm smearing over.
Psi q is just, is it, what is psi q?
Yeah, so I guess psi is the wave function and then it's a function of position. So that's why it's a function of q. So I'm squaring it to get a probability. So specifically, I'm technically going to have like eigenstates size of n, but they're going to be in this interval of size epsilon around E that I mentioned. And I guess that's what this notation is going to mean. It's just averaging in this window of size epsilon. Yeah.
So why does epsilon have to be smaller than E?
Because I want it to be a small window around my energy. I don't want it to be comparable to the size of the energy. Like it's supposed to be small. So like, that's how I am defining small. It's just that epsilon is a lot less than E.
What if I want to look at like very low energies or something? Can I compute these quantities or no?
I think you would generally still want the energy window to be smaller than the actual energy. Okay. Yeah.
So we pick some eigenstates corresponding to some unstable orbit and then do this smearing. Is that what?
Yeah, so these are eigenstates of the Hamiltonian.
Uh-huh.
And then I am smearing over energy. So I'm just averaging nearby eigenstates is basically all I'm saying. Yeah.
I see.
Right, just because I can't get the individual eigenstates. Yeah. Yeah, so this is really not meant to be a big window. It's just meant to be like maybe a few eigenstates that are nearby or something like that.
Oh, wait, I have another question.
Yeah.
Do you have a is the energy E arbitrary positive value, or you have some threshold?
Yeah, so E will be the energy corresponding to the eigenstate.
So it can be arbitrary, arbitrary positive value.
Yeah, sure.
I see. Because in holography, we have threshold in black hole, like we have Hawking phase transitions.
Mm-hmm.
But here, it can be applicable for any values of E.
Yeah, I mean, I guess this is just a result in quantum mechanics, and I guess my answer is going to be in terms of E. I guess, and E is just going to correspond to whatever eigenstate I'm looking at. And I guess just a brief note, the details are not important, but I'm just going to evaluate this expression. And to do that, I'm just going to need this Green's function. And this Green's function is a function of energy. You don't have to worry about the exact details. And kind of just the way I'm going to do this is I'm going to start with a semi-classical Green's function, which the input to this, and this is also known as the Van Vleck propagator. So it's going to depend on your two endpoints that you're propagating between. So I'm calling that QA and QB if my endpoints are A and B, and T is elapsed time. And then this is just an expression kind of in the semi-classical chaos literature for what this propagator would look like. And it's summed over the potential classical paths that you might have between the two endpoints. And then what we do next is we transform from time to energy variables, because ultimately we want to work in terms of energy. And now just in terms of the ingredients that kind of go into the final SCAR formula that we get, is after we do this transform to energy variables, we get this quantity which is known as, it's sometimes called the abbreviated action and sometimes the Hamilton principle function. But this is what happens after you Lagrange transform the action to energy variables. And then kind of a nice thing that you can do with it is if you take the derivative with respect to the position at the endpoints, you get the momenta at the endpoints. So kind of visually, the picture we have is we have this path in phase space, and we have the endpoints A and B. We have position and momenta at the endpoints, it is at fixed energy E. And then what we want to consider, because I guess in this expression earlier, kind of we set QA equal to QB. So that is a periodic orbit, is basically where we're setting the endpoints equal to each other. We call the period T, but in addition, for it to be a periodic orbit, like we don't want to just have the endpoints equal. We also need the momenta to be equal at the endpoints, because otherwise I guess it could do some loopy thing and then go off wherever. So that's the other condition we have for what it means to be exactly periodic. And then this is just like some notation that I'm going to use later on, but I'm just going to abbreviate the second derivative matrix. So this is the periodic orbit picture. Not really. It's just going to appear in the formula that I'm going to put up later, but also the exact details of the formula are not going to be like super important. So this is the second derivative matrix. Okay. The first derivatives gave us the momenta. Another thing I can do is I can split into directions parallel to and perpendicular to a periodic orbit. So if I call O the space of the images of the periodic orbits, so here's like this circle. I can split into delta q parallel is the direction parallel to O in the tangent space, and delta q perp is the perpendicular direction, so in the normal space. Actually for this work, what we want to consider are nearly periodic orbits. So this is an orbit where I'm going to say, so again, I'm going to set qA equal to qB, the endpoints equal, but then I'm going to set the momenta approximately equal to each other. So PA is approximately equal to PB. So in this picture I have over here, I have the exactly periodic orbit in the middle, but maybe like in this little zone around it, I have nearly periodic orbits.
So this means like it's periodic, but it might be momentum.
Yeah, so it might slightly wobble a little or something like that. Yeah. And kind of with all these ingredients, I can write down the formula, although on the next page I'm going to have the actual formula. But this is just, okay. Okay, something happened to the screen share.
the zoom dropped.
So it says it's still sharing. I don't know if I should just try to turn it off and turn it on again. Or...
yes.
Yeah, sure.
So these people, like Hera, these people kind of already knew this quantum scar back then, or?
Yeah, so actually, yeah, the quantum scar work was done in the 80s, but it was done in the, I guess, the few-body quantum mechanics case, yeah. Oh, awesome, it's back. I guess, should we wait for Alex to get back? Okay, cool. Yeah, thanks. Sorry about that. So in terms of the ultimate, I guess the formula we get, kind of the setup that we want to consider is, so again, I have this exactly periodic orbit here, and I have this zone around it that is the nearly periodic orbits. And what we find is that the SCAR formula applies in the regime of being in a nearly periodic orbit that is near an exactly periodic orbit. So over here in this like little blue region, that is where I find that I have first my microcanonical ensemble term and then the SCAR correction term on top of that. And if I am far enough away from the nearly periodic orbits, then I see just thermalization, so just the microcanonical ensemble. So there are cases that are not covered by this after we kind of go through and like try to rederive these formulas. So most notably, if like you happen to have, say, a nearly periodic orbit that is not near an exactly periodic orbit, then we kind of don't have anything to say. Like our formula does not apply. But kind of usually in the situations that we're interested in, like what we have is exactly the setup here. And so in equations, like this is kind of what I was just describing in the picture. And what we have this delta parameter that I mentioned before from the position smearing, which is going to set the scale for what it means. First of all, what it means to be nearly periodic, because here like h bar over delta is telling us like how much we're willing to tolerate in terms of the two momenta being not exactly equal to each other. And then also in terms of what we mean by how far we are from an exactly periodic orbit. So the Q perp, kind of the norm of Q perp is also going to be set by h bar over delta. So that's what one of the things that position smearing is going to do for us. And on the next slide, Yeah, sure.
These two cases exclusive to each other?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. Because, right, so one case is I am far away from the nearly periodic orbits. And then another case is, is when I am close to an exactly periodic orbit and I'm in a nearly periodic orbit.
So you only have these two cases.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah.
Thank you.
So we can't comment on, I guess, like I mentioned, the case where maybe you have a nearly periodic orbit that is not near an exactly periodic orbit. But I think in the applications we would normally be interested in, like we kind of wouldn't be thinking about that anyway, or we wouldn't expect that to occur generically.
Can I ask?
Yeah.
I mean, you're talking about the system P micro corresponding to something that's thermalized.
Yeah.
Does that mean I should think that P is uniform, P micro Q is uniform, and then there's a blip, or that the P scar is kind of a blip on that uniform distribution?
Yeah, so I was going to give you the exact
expressions
on next. No, you're good. But yeah, I mean, this is a lot to look at, but just here's the microcanonical ensemble term. So this is basically like, a delta function on my fixed energy surface, but with this tolerance for the smearing window. And this is basically, saying that everything at equal energy is equally probable. The denominator is just like normalization. And then the delta P-scar term, I think the important thing to note here is, yeah, so again, this is just like the normalization that I had over here. But it's going to have a term that looks like the imaginary part of e to the I something of an exponential. So that's going to look like oscillatory. So it's going to give me the fringes that like we would expect scars to look like. So I guess that's a term on top of this one. And then another thing to note is, OK, so this is like the delta that I was talking about that sets the scale for the position smearing. And I guess what we want to note here is that h bar over the maximum value of the action, so s max, is going to be the dimensionless quantity that tells me what it means to be small. And then this quantity over here is just going to give me the right dimensions, which is length for delta. And again, just things to note in the formula was, yeah, so we have oscillatory fringes. And also another thing was that what energy smearing gave us was that there's this term that goes like e to the minus epsilon t over h bar. So what that means is that long orbits are suppressed. And that's nice because it's kind of hard to say something about long orbits anyways in a generic like chaotic system. And what position smearing did for us was if you actually evaluate that Gaussian, we get a term that is proportional to the difference between PA and PB with this delta squared scale. And so that's what lets us suppress orbits that are far from nearly periodic. And again, this formula can be applied to both stable and unstable orbits. So that is the, and yeah, OK, so just another note is, so previously in the literature, people, I guess in these papers from the 80s, people took the semi-classical limit to be just h bar going to 0. But this actually like doesn't completely make sense because h bar has dimensions. And so what we're doing is we're working with h bar over s max. And this was a thing that I think was not clarified in the previous literature. But yeah. So now I'll talk about how we generalize this to the field theory case, having set it up in the quantum mechanics case. So now in the field theory case, we're going to work with a complex scalar field. And also, I guess the thing to note is that now that we're in field theory, we have infinite degrees of freedom. So before, like q was the variable, and now we have phi, which is a function of position. So we have a phi for every single possible position. And so that could, I mean, that's normally infinite. And the fact that we're working with a scalar means that we can write it in two components. So phi is equal to phi 1 plus I phi 2, where phi 1 and phi 2 are real. And now we just want to define our inner products, keeping in mind the fact that we're now working with infinite degrees of freedom. And also just taking account of the fact that this field has two components. So we're just always going to make sure we're summing over the one and two components. So we can define inner products. We can also define functional derivatives with respect to the fields. So we're also going to use that as well. Right, because we're generalizing derivatives of q now to functional derivatives with respect to phi. So as before, so I guess normally in field theory, we kind of like to work with Lagrangians. But it turns out it's also like perfectly fine to work with a Hamiltonian and with eigenstates, which are now going to be functions of phi. So now we have eigenstates psi of phi. And this index n with which I index the eigenstates can generically be a continuous index. But for now, I'm just going to write it as n. And again, we can define an energy window of size epsilon around E, where E is energy corresponding to the eigenstate. And so again, I get an expression that looks like this. And again, we can also do energy smearing and position smearing. So here, the position smearing is going to be in field space. And so so this integral is over the fields, chi. And then just over here in this thing that measures the distance between two fields, that's hiding an integral over the over x, which is the position where the fields are evaluated at. So again, we want to work with the Van Vleck propagator, and we derive this in field theory. We again transform to energy variables. And now in energy variables, we can again consider what a path might look like between two points. So now the points are in field space. So I have the endpoints A and B. And then at point A, I have the field phi A with conjugate momentum pi A. And similarly at point B, I have the field and its conjugate momenta. And again, I can take functional derivatives now of the fields at the endpoints and end up with the momenta at the endpoints. And as before, I can also obtain periodic orbits. So again, I set the fields equal to each other at the endpoints, and I set the momenta equal to each other at the endpoints. And I'm also going to just abbreviate this second derivative matrix. It's going to appear in the expression itself, but it's not super important. But another thing to note that is different in the field theory case versus the normal quantum mechanics case is that like the field theory itself can have certain symmetries. So normally we would expect like translational symmetry, potentially additional symmetry. And that means that this orbit can also be translated or moved in whatever way. So now the space of the images of the periodic orbits, which we called O, can have additional structure. So an orbit itself might look like S1, but the space of O might look like S1 cross RD cross potentially like more dimensions. And again, we can split into directions parallel to and perpendicular to the periodic orbit. So we can split into the delta phi parallel direction, which is going to be finite, and the delta phi perp direction is in general going to be infinite. And now if I kind of look at what the scar formula looks like, again, I have this picture that generalizes from the few body quantum mechanics case, except now that the space O could be a lot more complicated. But again, so near O, when we talk, and again, we're talking about near in the sense of nearly periodic, we expect to see the scar correction. But far away from this band around O, we would expect to just see the result of thermalization for the microcanonical ensemble. And again, our smearing parameter delta is what sets the scale for what we mean by nearly periodic in terms of the difference between the momenta at the endpoints and what we mean by close to O, so in terms of the norm of delta phi perp. And again, here's the expression, which we don't have to worry too much about the details. But so again, delta over there, kind of the small parameter we're interested in is going to look like h bar over the maximum value of the action, because again, that is what's going to be dimensionless. And then the first thing is just going to give us the dimensions of delta, which because delta goes like phi is going to be dimensionless. And I guess these are the expressions themselves. But again, so Tmax, so T is the period. And so Tmax is like the largest period that you can have.
Uh-huh.
And that kind of, so E Tmax is going to go like maybe S max. And again, all of that is just large compared to H bar and kind of just assess the scale for what we mean by small. But again, the scars can be seen as oscillatory fringes. And again, energy smearing is going to give us this e to the minus epsilon t over h bar term, which means that we can ignore the contributions from the super long orbits. And again, position smearing is going to pick out nearly periodic orbits for us. And this formula, again, applies to both the stable and unstable orbits. So now we want to find an example in field theory that actually satisfies the criteria of the scar formula and that would actually have scars. So this specific example that we kind of found was what are known as Q balls and Q clouds. So the case of Q balls is like from this paper in 1985 by Sidney Coleman. And then Q clouds are kind of in this. Is there also a Zoom meeting or?
Yeah, I think someone just forgot to mute themselves.
Okay, cool, that's fine, all right. So specifically for what a Q-ball is, so it's a specific type of soliton that is stabilized by U1 charge. So I guess generally when we have solitons, we expect it to be when we have like a nonlinear potential, and that's the case here. So what our potential is going to look like is we're going to have the mass term, and then we're going to have this quartic term that ensures that the whole potential grows like slower than just the phi squared mass term. And then the solutions will minimize energy at fixed charge. And it turns out that the solutions are going to take the form of e to the I omega t times some sigma of r. So the periodic part of this is the e to the I omega t. And that's the sense in which these are periodic orbits. And then if we kind of plug this solution back into the equations of motion, we'll just find some equation that kind of like we can solve for sigma if we want. And in terms of what these look like, so the stable solutions are known as Q balls. The unstable solutions are known as Q clouds. And the Q cloud limit is taking omega to m. And so visually, I think in this plot, we have m equal to 1. And then you can see that as omega approaches 1, the profile of the Q ball kind of like flattens out. And that's the sense in which it's called a Q cloud. It's just that it looks more like a cloud. So it is less localized. So these are Q balls and Q clouds. And yeah, so the point is that the Q clouds are going to give us unstable periodic orbits. And then we just kind of characterize what the space of Q cloud solutions O might look like.
It's unstable in what sense?
So I guess there's this specific stability criteria. And I guess you can show that that when you take omega goes to m, it's unstable. So I think it's like.
So if I part of it a little bit, then it just flows to.
Yeah. I don't know if it would say flows to the cue ball, but I think you can specifically write down, like usually like stability is in terms of like the second derivative of like the energy function or something like that. And I think you can write down some conditions that look like that. I think off the top of my head, I don't want to say what they are because I might get it wrong. But you can write down specific conditions that look like the second derivative matrix. And then like you can look at the sign of the eigenvalues of the second derivatives. Yeah. So I guess we look at the space of Q cloud solutions to try to characterize them. And so in this case, we kind of specialized to 3+1 dimensions. Again, we have an energy window. So what we did was we took an existing Q cloud solution, perturb it a little, enforce that the perturbations satisfy the equations of motion. And then it turns out that the system of equations that you get from that can be characterized completely either analytically or numerically. And from that, we see that the space O of Q cloud solutions is actually 5-dimensional in 3+1D. So we have the space-time translations that we mentioned, and then energy deformations. And then also, the Q cloud example satisfies the conditions for the SCAR formula to hold that I discussed in the previous slide. So this is just an example that we have where you might actually see SCARs in field theory.
Can you show us a graph of something saying, here's my SCAR, or it wouldn't push that far? Very formal at this point, and I'm not sure what it really means.
So I agree that I guess you're saying that we didn't actually go and evaluate the actual SCAR formula. And I agree that we did not do that. So I guess part of the reason for that is also, something that we did not do was figure out how to regularize this functional determinant. Basically, there's a 1/2 pi here, but I guess because this is a determinant in field theory, there is like one of these for every point in space. So this is like formally an infinite, an infinite quantity. I guess to actually evaluate this, like you'd have to come up with some sort of regularization scheme. And that was something that we did not do in this work.
Well, can you tell me if I had a friend who was very good at numerics and they wanted to do an experiment to numerically simulate your phi to the fourth, mm-hmm. like phi squared plus phi to the fourth
yeah.
field theory, what experiment would they do and what would they see to say, aha, I saw any scars? Scars.
I mean, I think ideally, like you would maybe, or certainly in the few body quantum mechanics case, you could actually plug in like Q and evaluate the actual formula. And I guess I'm saying that in this case, maybe the main obstacle to doing that is just that the fact that some of these quantities are infinite. But I think there should be a way to regularize them. So, yeah. But yeah, but I think you can basically solve exactly for phi, which was basically like the solution that we wrote down for the cue balls, for example. It was just like use the I omega t times sigma. And I think you should be able to just plug it into the formula and evaluate it. Yeah.
That's right. I guess in principle, you mm-hmm. can compute this delta p scar in the case of just Gaussian field theory, for instance.
I think we wanted mainly to demonstrate that there are unstable periodic orbits. And I think the unstable part of it was, yeah, I guess, usually in field theory, people like in the original paper on Q clouds by Alford, I think he has a line that says, so we found this thing, but unfortunately it's not going to be that interesting to people because it's unstable. So so I think that was the main thing that we wanted to demonstrate is that there are unstable orbits as well.
I see. And in this cube and cube class case, mm-hmm. is a microcanonical ensemble dual to the canonical ensemble? I mean, like, I was wondering how it's related to the thermalization stuff. So originally, your motivation coming from the deviation from the thermalization, I guess.
So I guess this delta P scar term is a deviation from thermalization because the thermalization, the expression for thermalization would again just look like this, I guess, delta function over the fixed energy surface. So like microcanonical ensemble is like when I'm working with fixed energy. And I guess you mentioned the canonical ensemble, that is fixed temperature. And I think you can also like, there's also ways that you can state thermalization in terms of the canonical ensemble, yeah. Yeah, so in terms of the takeaways, I think my collaborator likes to say that in the course of this work, we have graduated from billiard balls to cue balls. I guess in general, like you can adapt tools from semi-classical chaos to quantum field theory. And a lot of these results were originally like results from the 80s. And kind of another thing to note is that in semi-classical quantum chaos, often we need to consider an ensemble of eigenstates rather than individual eigenstates. And it turns out that we sometimes have to smear to get a saddle that we want to use. So in terms of future directions, I think definitely something that is interesting is trying to find other examples of quantum scars in field theory. So just looking for other field contents where you might have unstable periodic orbits. And again, making these connections in the applications that I mentioned earlier more explicit. And we think that maybe this work we've done in kind of establishing this framework for thinking about quantum scars and quantum field theory could be helpful for this. So one is, the Rydberg many-body scars that I mentioned. So I guess the model that appears there is known as the PXP model. And it's just called that because it's like P are like projectors, and there's just like an X, sigma X in the middle. And the projectors are what project you onto the kinetic constraint, which is that sites next to each other cannot both be excited at the same time. But anyways, yeah, so the idea there would be to try to write down an effective field theory of the PXP model. So basically writing down a continuum model. And then in that case, we'd be able to apply techniques from our paper. And again, I think the question there that was just maybe unclear in terms of are these actually quantum scars is a question of like, in what sense are periodic orbits responsible for the phenomena that we're actually observing? So this could potentially help with that. And in terms of the application to gravity and to ADS-CFT, the question would be, can we use our tools to get maybe more of a bulk path integral understanding of holographic scars, just because our tools are based on the path integral. And I think a lot of the kind of the work that's already been done on holographic scars that are more on the CFT side. And then in general, there's the question of, you know, what other tools can we take from semi-classical quantum chaos and kind of pour over to QFT? And yeah, I think that is all the slides I have. So yeah, thanks so much. Thank you for all your questions.
Questions? So, maybe a high-level question.
Mm-hmm.
In this work, like, are you coming up with a tool to calculate these quantum many-body scars, or also like a mathematical definition of what it means to a quantum many-body scar in these QFTs?
Yeah, so I would say definitely a mathematical definition, first of all, just because, yeah, so we're taking the results from the few-body quantum mechanics case, and we're like telling you how to translate them to the field theory case. And I think also clarifying certain results in the few-body quantum mechanics case as well. Like, I think it was not always clear in what sense or in what regimes the scar formula applied. And I think we stated that very clearly. And also, I mentioned the confusion with taking the semi-classical limit. I think it's something that we clarified. Yeah, and I would say in the field theory case, just in terms of how you should think about scars and field theory, and I guess explicitly the connection to the original definition that Heller and all these like semi-classical chaos people gave.
So to understand correctly, so if for a QFT or something, if someone asked anyone to compute like a quantum many-body scar, this is not something they could have done before this work, or they would have done it incorrectly?
Yeah, so I think in terms of current approaches that there are, I think there are like algebraic approaches to quantum scars. This is kind of where people, I think, I'm not sure about the exact details, but I think they study it from a Hilbert space perspective. So I think like they write down a charge, a conserved charge, and they say, this is what like the tower of scar states I have looks like. But I think this doesn't connect back explicitly to this definition in terms of like periodic orbits. So I think what we're trying to do is we're trying to make the connection to the original definition clear as well. Yeah.
Thanks.
Do you think, just because you said the word conserved charge, could that be related to the charge that you were talking about that stabilized cue balls or seemed to play a role there?
So I think in general, that's not like a requirement to have quantum scarring, because this is a distinct phenomenon from like integrable systems, where like you know that you have certain conserved quantities that commute with a Hamiltonian. So I don't think it's like a requirement to have that, to have scarring. But I guess in the case of cue balls, like the conserved charge just happens to be what stabilizes a soliton.
No, I was just wondering though if there might be a relation between this other kind of approach to quantum scars and what you were describing in the case of the cue balls.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. And I think something that I've definitely wanted to do is kind of sit down and dig through, okay, what is the connection between this approach that people have in terms of the Hilbert space and like the actual definition that Heller had in terms of periodic orbits. But I think a priori, I would assume that you don't necessarily need to have conserved charges to have quantum scarring.
Can I ask a very nice question?
Yeah.
So, its name is quantum scar, so being quantum is very important. So this phenomena we never see if it's classical. I couldn't.
I think,
quantumness plays the role.
Yeah, I guess it is like an interference effect, and so that's the sense in which it's quantum. I guess in the billiards ball case, you can say, oh, these are like, I guess they are classical, like the scarring does happen along classical periodic orbits. But you would see it, I guess, in the wave function, because you get the probability distribution from the wave function. So I would say it's still an interference effect that you're seeing.
Any other questions? No, let's thank the speaker.
All right, thanks so much.